So I'll be talking about topological quantum computation today, and in particular about this thing.
So so let me explain why I talk about it. So it's not my own work that I'll be talking about today. It's rather work by Nusinov and Ortiz concerning the stability of the Tauri code and the implications that it likely may have for topological quantum computation. So what they have shown is that if you consider the Tauri code in a Hamiltonian setting, that is, you have an energy penalty for states outside the code space, then this does not give you a fault-tolerant quantum memory. And this is in contrast with another result that there exists on the Tauri code, which is in a setting where you repeatedly measure the error syndrome and correct accordingly. For that setting, a threshold is proven. So yeah, I think at certain times people thought these results were contradicting each other, but that's not really the case. They really apply to different settings and therefore can be different. Okay, so that is a result that I want to review. And I want to point out that this is not restricted to the Tauri code alone, which is a pretty special case, but likely it has an implication for topological quantum computation in general. So, but before I come to that, I just give a brief review of topological quantum computation, and it will be very sketchy. So this is a rather nice introductory article to topological quantum computation. On the back of the page, what you see here is a cup, a coffee mug, and a donut, right? So I want to be as sketchy as that here in my introduction. So consider two particles that are indistinguishable from another and their exchange. So in quantum mechanics, we know, well, we have two types of particles, fermions and bosons, and their wave functions behave in a certain way under the exchange. Namely, to the bosonic wave function, nothing happens, and the wave function of fermions acquires a minus sign. So the question is, can other things happen? The simplest generalization certainly would be if we can pick up other faces under exchange. And the answer of whether that's possible or not depends upon the dimensionality of the system. So in larger than two dimensions, we cannot have anything else than faces plus and minus. And this is because a clockwise exchange can be continuously deformed in a counterclockwise exchange. And therefore, they must give the same result, implying that an exchange either clockwise or counterclockwise squared gives you the identity. And therefore, the matrix that describes an exchange can only have eigenvalues plus and minus one in these cases. If we go to one dimension, the question is ambiguous because the particles would need to move through another under exchange and then could interact directly. So the case of two dimensions is the only remaining case where something more general could happen, and it does happen. So in the simplest case, we acquire additional faces, but that is not all that is possible. Or I should say, because in two dimensions, any face is essentially possible under exchange, the corresponding particles that arise have been called anions. Now suppose you have n such anions, and they would give rise to a joint Hilbert space of dimension k that we could now act upon by exchanging these particles. The corresponding operations on the Hilbert space would be unitary ones. And now, apply them in some order. And then the interesting case is when the unitaries corresponding to the exchanges do not commute. This can happen, or well, it is conjectured to happen, I should say, in realistic physical systems. And if this condition is obeyed, then we have non-abelian anions, and that's the interesting case. For quantum computation, being non-abelian is a prerequisite for being universal. But you can be non-abelian without being universal. And so I'll ask the question whether there are any restrictions on these unitaries. And it's really rather a dummy question. I want to point out something else. But anyway, there are restrictions to these unitaries. Yes, Robin? Yeah?
So the bosons and fermions, the statistics are derived from starters by saying they're identical particles, and so exchanging two of them should not change observable properties of the wave function. Therefore, it can only change it by a phase.
Mm-hmm.
But in what you've just said, we're going to be doing non-trivial unitaries mm-hmm. that are acting on this joint Hilbert space just by exchanging the particles, which obviously violates the idea that the wave function doesn't change except by a phase. Doesn't that sort of mean that they're not really identical particles? I'm just confused here at a fundamental level.
Let me think. Well, you would actually, I mean, in this case, so what happens is, I mean, Daniel was waving his hand, so maybe he has a better explanation for the whole thing. But sort of the situation that you were referring to was when you said the exchange shouldn't have any observable consequence. Well, then you just allow yourself just to look at the present time and not at the history of the system. But I mean, in this more general setting, the history definitely matters. So what you have done to these particles in the past does definitely matter. So yeah, you wouldn't allow that argument to apply, that you can say you're only allowed to consider sort of the present. Sort of the system at the given fixed time, but I mean I don't know. That probably doesn't resolve your question. Anyway, Daniel, what would you say?
So I mean, these non-abelian anions have degrees of freedom that are not attached to individual particles.
Yes.
So there are things that cannot be measured locally. If you just are around one particle, all the states look the same. But if you look at a group of them, like the four anions that Robert's drawn there, then you can collectively find the state of all four particles together. And in fact, this is not a tensor product Hilbert space. You add new particles, you're not tensoring off the increase of freedom. It grows exponentially, but in a more complicated way.
Okay.
Yeah. So exactly. So yeah, we can have. Okay. So then let me continue with this slide here. So I wanted to talk about constraints among these unitaries. And here's one, that's the Young-Baxter relation. So suppose we have three anionic particles here, whatever their character is. And if we exchange the first pair first, then the second, and then again the first, it is the same thing as doing it the other way around. Exchanging the second part first, the second pair, excuse me, first, then the first pair, then the third pair. And the reason for that is topological. So you just slide through that, I forgot to mention that the vertical arrow here represents time. So
So what you do is, to show this equivalence, is you slide through this particle world line. And in this way, you convert this diagram into this diagram. So it's just a continuous deformation. It is not a change of the topology. And what that system does only depends upon the topology. So, and this fact is actually used and is argued to the effect that what is used to argue that topological quantum computation is resilient against errors and would not need methods of quantum error correction. So suppose I had a way, first to in a physical system, to excite these particles in a controlled way, and then to grip them and drag them around. Then I could allow myself control errors in these paths. And as long as these control errors were not so big that I would actually change the topology of my paths, then this would have no effect to my topological quantum computation whatsoever. Okay, and this gives rise to the robustness of topological quantum computation, at least against this source of errors. So the question is, are there other errors that need to be considered? And sort of this will then lead me to the second part of my talk. But before I get there, let me just say this has actually a connection to the real world. So anions do exist. For example, in two-dimensional electron gases in the fractional quantum Hall regime. And both abelian and non-abelian anions have been predicted. However, as far as I know, where do they occur? Well, they occur at the Hall plateaus. But as far as I know, none of the predictions has been confirmed or refuted. So I know of no experiment that demonstrates braiding statistics so far. So this is something that remains to be done experimentally, and it's very hot. But there are two particular hot plateaus that look promising from the theory side, at least. And this is the one at filling fraction 5/2 and 12/5. So in theory, this is the simplest or most reachable Hall plateau that shows non-abelian braiding statistics. And it is, however, not universal, per se. And this filling fraction is both non-abelian and universal. But the experimental status is such that this Hall plateau is routinely seen. Also, another aspect of it has been verified, namely the associated fractional charge that has been experimentally tested. But non-abelian braiding is not yet confirmed. And for this state, which would be more desirable even, the situation is worse. I mean, the Hall plateau isn't even routinely seen. Okay, so the second part of my talk will be about a much simpler system that we can argue about much more easily. And it is the toric hope. And it has been introduced by Alexei Pitayev more than 10 years ago. And I explain it on the next couple of slides. And just to conclude this introductory part, this is a recent review article in Review of Modern Physics about topological quantum computation that has been written by, I think, some of the best-known people in the field, like Chetan Nayak and Zankar Dasam and Michael Friedman. And well, it has a long list of topics that it covers. But look here. We are talking about errors, too. So even in topological quantum computation, we need to talk about errors. And I would like to talk about this in the simpler setting of the toric code. And the word that comes into play here is that by Lucinov and Fortis, which I would like to review. Oh, excuse me. Could I actually, Robin, would you be so kind as to bring me a glass of water? Thanks.
So, okay, so let me briefly define the toric code and the setting in which Nusinov and Ortiz discuss it. So here we have a code surface, which is just a planar graph. And with each edge of that graph, planar graph, we associate a qubit. And then the toric code is a stabilizer code. And the stabilizer generators also have a geometrical interpretation. Namely, they live on the sides and on the plaquettes. And the plaquette type stabilizer operators have that form. They are fourfold tensor products of sigmas. Oh, thank you. Thank you. They are fourfold tensor products of sigma z. And the other ones here, they are associated with the sides of that graph or lattice, and they are fourfold tensor products of sigma x, and they are mutually commuting. So that's the toric code. And now you can do various things with it. One thing you can do is you write down an associated Hamiltonian that's just the sum of all these operators. Well, the energy eigenstates of that Hamiltonian will also be eigenstates of all these operators. And the toric sort of the code state manifold will have the lowest energy, so it will correspond to the ground state manifold of that Hamiltonian. And now you could ask yourself the question, how stable is such a code against thermal noise, for example? And this is what Nusinov and Ortiz answer, and this is what I'm going to get to later. But first, I would like to continue a little bit with the toric code and then introduce to you another setting in which you could use the toric code. But anyway, so here you have a toric code with on various surfaces. So if you have a plane with these boundary conditions, no space for a qubit, just gives you a state. Here you have a two-dimensional code space giving you one qubit. The torus gives you two. So the message is, the capacity to store encoded qubits only depends upon the topology of the surface, not the size. So what's the point of making the surface bigger then? Well, the point is that you hope that your code word or your code states become better protected as you increase the code surface. And the question that we want to investigate is whether this is indeed the case. In the setting that I already introduced, and in another setting that I'm going to introduce. Okay, anyway, here I'm just briefly talking about the excitations of that model. So you could violate these plaquette type stabilizer conditions in pairs, and this would get you up on the energy ladder by 2 times g, which was our energy parameter. And you can, there are sort of two types of excitations, so-called magnetic excitations and electric excitations. And you can move them around another. You can take an electric excitation, move it around a magnetic one, and that gets you a phase. That changes the state. OK, but the question we want to address is stability of the code. So here is the other setting that the toric code can be used that I promised to discuss. So it is a setting where we repeatedly measure the stabilizer operators. So remember, for our code state manifold, all these operators must have fixed eigenvalues plus one. So, well, these stabilizer generators are observables, so I might as well measure them continuously and figure out if these conditions are still obeyed. And if they are not obeyed, well, then from the measurement outcomes that I get, I try to figure out what happened to the code and correct accordingly. OK, so what's topological here? Well, so here here is something that we call an error chain. So remember, the qubits were located in the middle of these edges. So what's happening here is that we have a Pauli phase flip error occurring on all these edges that I have indicated here by a thick line. So how do we know that something happened to the code surface? Well, this error reveals itself here at these points. And that's true for any such error chain. It is revealed only at the endpoints. Now, there are many such chains ending in two points. So how do we distinguish between them? Well, we don't need to. So all we need to guess about that chain is its homology class. So two error chains that are equivalent up to homology, that is, differ by the boundary of a surface, have the same effect on the code space, despite the fact that they are different physical operations. So we are only interested in guessing the homology class of errors rather than error chains themselves. And this is the topological aspect here. So this setting has been discussed fairly extensively in a paper by Dennis, Kitayev, Landau, and Preskill in 2001. And the only important point here, or the most important point, is that this does lead, provably, to a fault-tolerant regime if your error rate is low enough. And sort of an interesting point is that the performance of the error correction procedure can be mapped to a model from classical statistical mechanics. All right, and I'm sketching the phase diagram here, but I want to be brief about it. So again, well, we have a low temp, so this is temperature. This is a parameter I haven't explained yet. I'm not sure I should, but yeah, maybe I should explain it. And well, we have a low temperature phase here and a high temperature phase. And the low temperature phase is ordered and corresponds to a regime where error correction does work. And then we have a region out here where it fails. And to reiterate the main point, there is a point in this phase diagram where error correction provably works. And this, well, this is sort of at a finite error rate. Okay, but anyway, maybe I briefly say what this model of statistical mechanics is here. So it lives on a three-dimensional lattice. Why three dimensions? Well, the toric code gives us two, and then when we are doing the error correction, we include the entire system syndrome history, or the entire error history, so which gives us time at the third axis. And error correction looks at the whole, all of it, gives us three dimensions. Anyway, the classical mechanics model is as follows. We have a three-dimensional lattice of spins which can point up and down. And they live on the edges of that lattice. And the interaction, so this is sort of the sketched elementary cell, the interaction is fourfold. It couples four spin. Sort of the relevant term in the Hamiltonian is the product of these four spins. And this coupling has a certain strength, J. And the absolute value of the coupling is the same everywhere in this entire lattice. But sometimes the sign is wrong. And this happens at random locations. And the probability for these couplings having the wrong sign gives you the second parameter P here of that phase diagram. OK? And if we map from our error correction model, these two parameters are related. So you really live on that line of the phase diagram. Anyway, the point here is a threshold exists. So now let's go back to the Hamiltonian setting and analyze the situation over there. So what one could do here is So now we are sitting, discussing a Hamiltonian setting again. That was our initial scenario, where we have this Hamiltonian. And outside of that system, we have a temperature. We have an environment at a certain temperature that couples to that system. And under these conditions, now let's assume we prepare a certain code word here. With this code, say it's the encoded Pauli operator sigma x. Well, and then, well, probably over time, the expectation value of sigma, of the encoded sigma x will decay. Well, this is unavoidable, and it doesn't matter. The question is just on what time scale this will happen. And the way we phrase it, we look at the autocorrelation function of sigma x. Okay? So the question is, what's the characteristic time for that decay? And this is what Nusinov and Ortiz worked out. So first, this autocorrelation function decays with a stretched exponential, and the characteristic time scale for that is given here. And there are two parameters that enter. One is the temperature, so it depends, as expected, very strongly on the temperature. And this is just a sort of a clock speed of the system that goes into that parameter. So what Nusinov and Ortiz now observe is that this thing, although it becomes very, very big when the temperature becomes small, is continuous in the temperature. So there are no distinct phases. There's no phase transition at a finite temperature. So that's what they point out. And for us, if you're interested in quantum error correction, there is another point to observe here. This time, this characteristic time over which the decay happens, is totally independent of the system size. So normally, what you would want to have in a code is that sort of the accuracy of your code, or sort of, yeah, sort of the remaining error rate after a successful error correction, goes exponentially in the overhead you spend. You want to make your code sort of, yeah, if you make your code bigger, then you want your remaining error rate to be exponentially small in that expense. And here, what we find, we can make the code surface bigger, and it has absolutely no effect. And in this sense, this is not a fault-tolerant quantum memory. OK, so how can we explain this sort of in a diagrammatic way? Well, so what happens is that we can excite with a certain probability pair two particles here. And well, that happens, well, this requires energy. So it will be suppressed by a Boltzmann factor. So it may be very, very unlikely, but it happens with a certain fixed probability. So if these particles do not immediately re-annihilate, so what happens is that they drift around on the surface. And then eventually, they will re-annihilate. And now that whether they affect the code or not affect the code is whether they have looped around the code surface and even on odd number of times. So most likely, they will have looped around the code surface zero times. Sometimes they loop around it once and twice, I think, is even more rare. So the probability, so you have a finite probability that an error occurs. And if you make your code surface bigger, the random walk has to be longer. And therefore, sort of one enclosed loop will be a little bit suppressed as opposed to including no loop at all. But this effect is outweighed by the fact that the surface becomes bigger, and therefore it is more likely to create a pair. And these effects cancel, and therefore you end up with a situation that, well, making your code surface bigger, it doesn't improve the situation at all. And so this is just what I said. So this is the harmful process. Thermal excitation of a pair, drift, an odd number of loops, and recombination. So but that, sort of this process here is not particular to the Torrey code, but rather is general to any setting in which you do topological quantum computation. And so again, just as a diagram, so suppose these are your computational anions sitting at regular spots in on your codes, or excuse me, on your surface. And well, there may stray anions may be occasionally excited just thermally. That may be a very rare event, but it will happen. And then these guys drift around, include more than one anion before they re-annihilate, and this will lead to computational errors. So therefore, my conclusion part one is that even in topological computation, because this process is fairly general, even there you should have a small error rate. So I think from the computer scientist point of view, no matter how small the error rate is, you end up sort of in the same class, sort of what error correction, the overhead that error correction usually gives you is this. If O is the size of your computation without including any errors and any overhead for error correction, then the four tolerant version of that computation has a size O times a polylogarithmic factor. And yeah, so you'll have this. So topological quantum error correction is in the same class. It will need some error correction too, and that brings it here into this class. But sort of this is not the note I want to end on, but rather I would still emphasize the fact that this error rate can be made very, very small just by tuning the temperature. And therefore, I think error correction will kick in only for very, very large computation sizes. So remember, what I had here is a result for the scaling limit. But I mean, this will not be reached anytime soon. So here, this is sort of what I want to end with. Here you see a plot by Manny Knill of how many physical gates you need for an individual CNOT gate, right? It's huge numbers, and this is plotted versus the physical error rate. And you see that you gain, and I should say, these various curves are for various computational sizes. So, but anyway, you see the threshold is somewhere here in this diagram. So you see, as you go to lower and lower error rates, and you don't have to go very far below the threshold, maybe an order of magnitude, you are saving orders of magnitude in terms of overhead. So my conclusion is that even if topological quantum computation requires error correction, then it may still be the way to go. And maybe it takes both ideas, error correction and topological quantum computation, to finally build a working quantum computer. All right, so thank you very much for your attention. Yeah?
To see if my understanding is correct, the problem with the model being, you know, sort of indefinitely robust is essentially that you can have creation of extraneous anions.
Yeah. I would argue this way. I mean, maybe there are other sources, but this is certainly maybe the dominant source that needs to be taken into account.
So why did it take 10 years to realize this? I mean, in retrospect, it seems like it's sort of an obvious thing to consider. I say that as a complete outsider. I mean, just...
I don't know. I mean, really, I don't know. Probably the people who work on this on a daily basis
I think they knew it for a long time. So, but maybe that is, so my impression is that it just wasn't publicized. And so then there's the Nusinov Ortev results. So depending on whom you ask, also maybe that's a little bit interesting. So I went once to a workshop where both Nusinov were and Kuro Stenger. And so I asked Nusinov about this, and Kuro Stenger was on the table, and Kuro said right away, look, this is totally trivial. And then Nusinov said, well, okay, but we're not getting our paper published because the referee insists that can't be true. So, yeah. So I think there's really, I think the people who work on this, they knew it, but I think there's some people who do not work on this on a daily basis. I think that may be somewhat novel and interesting. Yeah.
So you made some comments a moment ago. You said that the situation, the temperature is a problem, and it's a problem for all quantum computing.
Yeah.
So when you don't want to do topological quantum computing, the goal is usually to separate the system from the environment and put it in some highly non-equilibrium state. Looks nothing like a thermal state.
Yeah.
So temperature doesn't really enter. If you look at time scales that are short compared to the time scale where the system would right?
Mm-hmm.
So would you be able to think of a topological quantum computing scheme where you could just eliminate interaction from the environment with the environment as well in order to also eliminate these errors? The system, maybe cool the system locally. I mean, I guess that's what you do anyway. You cool down whatever system.
Yeah, I guess cooling the system locally in a way. Well, I mean, of course, I mean these systems are cooled, right? To the best degree you can, but then on top of that, I mean, what you want to do is you want to trace these stray anions and measure when they occur and then keep track of them.
But I think there's an additional issue. Additional issue is, does the system reach a thermal equilibrium state? Is it in contact with a large bath at some given temperature? That sets it at some, to a Boltzmann distribution. So this is the fundamental assumption in these calculations, that the system is in thermal equilibrium with some bath at temperature T.
Mm-hmm. But it's not that it's no, I don't it. Think it's, an, it's just getting there. It's just, it's
up yeah. Equilibrium and how long will it take to
yeah.
measure this work?
No. Yeah, but
it totally depends on the gap and T.
But I'm,
well, yeah, so well, I would think, well, yeah, I would think probably that it is in thermal equilibrium.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well. Of course. I mean, if you sort of, if this is your computational surface, so say the ground state is no particle there, and then you have your computational anions, then you are very far away from thermal equilibrium.
Yeah.
But I mean, sort of the system is trying to get you towards thermal equilibrium. And what it does, the environment does that. And sort of what it starts doing is creating extra particles.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that you are a priori immediately in thermal equilibrium, but you're sort of working your way towards this. And even as this starts, it gets you in trouble.
Yeah.
Can I? So I'm not familiar with this notion of work, but the Horodeskis and Robert Talicki worked out in this amazing thing. And they do work in thermal equilibrium and just study the correlation, the autocorrelation in time, right? So trying to see, I mean, which is the time that it takes to depolarize your quantum memory. I mean, you're all the time in the thermal state. So. I don't know if that's what you were.
So you're saying they consider doing a computation in a thermal equilibrium state accounting for some small population. It's
So you don't really, I mean, they don't consider realistic being able to reach the ground state.
And is it known, so which source of error, has anyone estimated on physical grounds which source of error would be larger? The ones that you were talking about, these excitations, or the errors from just not being close to thermal equilibrium at reasonable temperatures? Some system.
I don't know. I mean, sort of, if you're talking about the toric code, well, just try to come up with a way to do a four-body interaction. So I think this, I don't know, I think that that would be very difficult to do. So I think nobody put in numbers here, as far as I know.
But people could put in numbers for the paths or both the state.
Oh,
the size of the gap.
Oh, cool.
Estimate.
They they could, and well, yeah. I mean, I think it strongly depends on the temperature that you're going to get. I think this is the most important factor that goes in here, and I mean you, and that you would somehow need to predict. Oh, how do I say this? I mean, I should say, practically, what I discussed about is not a concern for topological quantum computation because it's only a theoretical concern regarding the scaling limit. But sort of, we are not going to approach the scaling limit anytime soon. So as soon, I mean, you can probably start operating topological quantum computation when you are about, say, a tenth of the gap with your temperature, but the problem is to get there. So right now you don't even reach the gap for most ratios. So if you want to plug the numbers, the most important question is which number to plug in for the temperature, I would say. But I mean, I would really like to say, before I get to Robin, sort of this, what I pointed out here, this is just sort of a theorist computer scientist concern. Practically, I mean, if topological quantum computation gets to work reasonably, then with a little bit of extra effort, you get it working very well. And then until very large system sizes, you do not need to worry about these things.
So this is sort of half comment, half question with respect to the previous discussion. I think one of the things that gets most confusing in talking about models like this and condensed matter is the use of the very term temperature, right? I mean, temperature presupposes thermal equilibrium. And when we're doing information processing, we are by definition always out of thermal equilibrium. So what we mean is that something is approximately at some temperature. I think it helps a lot to be specific about what's
the bath,
at a temperature. So
the
in this
environment.
Case, do you mean the environment outside of the 2D electron fluid,
yeah,
or some degrees of freedom of the 2D electron fluid itself?
So so what I've been discussing here technically was, I mean, what I've been reviewing here was Nusinov and Ortiz result. And this is just about spins in a toric code's surface. And on that level, sort of, it's the environment is sort of outside,
okay.
And that's sort of at a certain temperature, and it's interacting with your system.
Do they use a separate bath for each environment, for each qubit?
Well, I mean, I haven't read the paper, but I assume it's, you know, some infinite perfect thermal bath, right?
Yeah.
So that's what it matters. Right?
Yeah.
It's the same bath or separate ones. It's temperature. Yeah.
It doesn't matter how it's coupled to the qubits, though.
Not if the bath is completely perfect. I mean, that is some, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Is it a path that can be coupled in any way as long as it's low?
As long as it's what?
As long as the coupling is low. Or all you ask from the bath. Because if you can choose the clamping, how it clamps, then you can have a decoherence three times.
I would just add that there is kind of an extra source of errors because you have to move anions, and in doing that you are not going to be able to do it perfectly possibly, and then that will introduce like this kind of creations of additional anions that you don't really want, right?
Say it again. Sort of the why does the moving of the anions? Because it creates sort of, you say, the moving itself.
Moving itself will be perfect, right?
Yeah.
And then,
mm-hmm.
So it's not only about texture, but also about how well are you able to do these things. And so it's not completely clear to me that moving anions wouldn't be, supposing that we were able to do such a thing.
Yeah, and I think this is the big suppose. I think, and then sort of the interesting examples, it is not known how to direct that around.
Yeah, the good point is that you perhaps don't need to move them, but just to measure areas and then
I
think that's much more promising.
You mean there is this Bondersson, you mean that the Bondersson Friedman Nayak thing? Yeah. So what they do is they replace braiding by measuring topological charge in certain regions. And they say they can do that more easily than braiding computational anions.
Yeah, and the point is that I think that I think that's better because it would fit better error correction, for example. I mean, for me, it makes sense to consider that setting of measurements and add to it the possibility that you have this kind of errors and what do you do about them.
Mm-hmm.
Much more.
But then, I mean, as far as I know, well, maybe we can talk about it later. I mean, then the question is, how they approximate a measurement of a topological charge and whether that does not introduce errors and so forth.
Yeah, well, I will just start considering that
it
is errorless, right? And then just combining it.
I mean, you could argue here that sort of that weakens the scheme if you have to approximate a topological charge measurement by something. But I think it's
important. But we can tell. I mean, it's still a topological aspect, right? Because these charges are integers.
Yes, but as far as I remember, you would want to do the topological charge measurement somehow, and I don't know the details of that, but they are using some interferometric processes to sort of do these measurements, but they correspond to a real topological charge measurement only in a certain limit, and then the question is how well this limit is obeyed, and if it is not, you introduce some errors, and then I would argue you weaken the scheme.
So,
all right.
That's it. Questions? Let's thank Robert again.